Welcome you to the deep dive. Today, we're focusing on something pretty complex. It's this intersection of high-stakes diplomacy, domestic politics, and some, well, deeply held religious prophecy.
Yeah, it's quite a mix.
Our mission is really to analyze the commentary around Donald Trump's big address on October 13th, 2025, to the Israeli Knesset.
Right, the Knesset.
The whole backdrop for this speech was, well, on the surface anyway, it looked like this huge diplomatic win, a brokered Gaza ceasefire, and this is key, the return of the last living Israeli hostages.
A really significant moment.
And our source material makes it clear Trump wanted to use that moment, that sense of relief and victory, to lay out a path to peace, a peace he kept saying would bring in a new golden age.
And that's our dive gets tricky because the sources themselves are unusual. We're not just looking at, you know, a standard analysis of the speech text.
No. What makes it different?
We've got the speech highlights, sure, but they're presented right alongside some extremely critical commentary, often very religiously charged commentary that looks at this supposed triumph with deep skepticism.
Okay.
So our job here is to pull out the facts of what actually happened, lay out the core arguments being made against that whole golden age idea, impartially, of course, and just try to understand the very different worldviews clashing here.
Absolutely. And the event itself, I mean, the sources describe it as pure spectacle, framed by just massive optimism. This was Trump's second time addressing the Knesset, right?
That's right. The first was back in 2017 when he announced moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem.
And this time the spectacle seemed designed to project, you know, strength, stamina. I read he gave a really long monologue, totally without note.
Yeah, that was noted. And the rhetoric, it wasn't just about ending a war. It was about crossing some kind of historical threshold.
How so?
Well, Trump declared this wasn't just the end of the war, but, quote, the end of an age of terror and death and the beginning of the age of faith and hope and of God.
Wow. That's a huge claim, theological, political.
It really is, basically asserting a fundamental shift in how the world works.
And he tied that into his broader vision, calling it the historic dawn of a new Middle East, saying that, kind of like his vision for the U.S., it will be the golden age of Israel and the golden age of the Middle East.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Linking Israel's future directly to that sort of American exceptionalism idea.
He didn't hold back on claiming credit for the recent wins either, did he?
Not at all. He called it an incredible triumph for Israel, praised the IDF's bravery, specifically mentioning Operation Rising Lion. And personally, he made sure to thank Jared Kushner for the earlier work on the Abraham Accords.
Which he called the Abraham Accords, I noticed.
Yes, he made a point of that, using the Hebrew, reinforcing that sort of historical, almost covenantal theme running through it.
Okay, let's talk Jerusalem. That's always the flashpoint, isn't it? What did he say there that might have been aimed at unifying people?
Well, he was addressing the assembly in Jerusalem, calling it the ancient and eternal now capital. That's standard enough.
Right.
But the key thing, I think, was his attempt at religious bridge building. He talked about Jerusalem as the holy center for the world's three great Abrahamic faiths.
And he used the city itself, how people live there now, as kind of proof that his vision could work.
Precisely. He highlighted what he called one of the modern miracles that Israel has given to the world, the fact that people of different faiths live and work side by side there.
So using Jerusalem's reality to say peace is possible, not just theoretical.
Exactly. He was using Jerusalem as the anchor for that whole age of hope idea, making it seem like an expansion of something already happening.
Okay, but this is where our source material takes a sharp turn. We go from this high-flying diplomatic theater to commentary that seems set on tearing it all down by focusing on tiny errors, like the so-called Freudian slip.
Yeah, this is a really key tactic by the commentator. They grab onto this one, quote, supposedly ad-libbed near the end of the speech. It reads, and that is why even after 3,000 years of pain and conflict, the people of Israel have never given up from the threats of Zionism, from all sorts of threats.
Wait, hang on. From the threats of Zionism, listing Zionism as a threat that Israel has overcome in the Knesset. That sounds completely wrong.
It's incredibly contradictory.
Yeah.
And the commentary just hammers this single word choice. They argue listing Zionism, there was either a massive mistake, a genuine Freudian slip, maybe showing he was tired or confused.
Or,
and this is the more damaging implication, that it was somehow a calculated knockout moment. The point is, by focusing on this one slip, the commentators suggest Trump secretly has negative feelings about Zionism itself.
Undermining his whole pro-Israel message just with that one word.
That's the strategy. question the sincerity of the whole speech based on that single perceived error.
It's a potent critique, but it didn't end there, right? There was another religious reference they flagged.
That's right, the mention of Calvary. When Trump was listing sacred sites in Jerusalem, he apparently threw Calvary in alongside the Western Wall and the Temple Mount.
Okay.
Now, for a Jewish audience, especially in the Knesset, the source argues this would cause intense cringing.
Why? What's so jarring about Calvary specifically in that list?
Because Calvary is, well, it's fundamentally linked to the crucifixion of Jesus, often placed on Mount Moriah, a site already deeply sacred in Judaism as the Temple Mount and also significant in Islam.
Ah, I see.
So to just casually drop that very specific Christian reference into a speech celebrating Israeli resilience in a Jewish legislative body, the critic sees it as profoundly insensitive. Clueless even about the deep historical and theological sensitivities.
So the commentary uses it not just as a gaffe, but as proof he doesn't really get the religious core of Israel?
Exactly. It feeds into this larger skepticism, this rejection of the whole Golden Age narrative. The commentary basically says the celebration is completely off base.
Why? Because the fighting might restart.
It's deeper than that for them. They argue the conflict is fundamentally ideological, religious. So even with a ceasefire, even with hostages back, the Israeli-Hamas war is not over. They claim Hamas will never lay down their weapons because of their core beliefs.
So Trump says the nightmare is finally over, but the commentary is saying
the complete opposite. They argue the forces of chaos and destruction are not defeated. And worse, they say the nightmare is actually only to begin.
To begin? Based on what?
Based on specific biblical prophecies. They explicitly reference the books of Daniel, Ezekiel, Zechariah, and Revelation.
Okay, we need to pause on that. For you listening, when the source brings up those specific books, they're putting this current political event into a pre-written prophetic timeline.
Precisely. They're essentially saying this ceasefire isn't a real victory. It's just a pause, maybe even a necessary pause, before the real prophesied end times conflict begins.
Yeah.
Like the Ezekiel War of Gog Magog they mentioned.
So from that perspective, political deals are almost irrelevant. The outcome's already decided.
That's the viewpoint driving this specific commentary. It's viewing everything through a theological lens where human diplomacy takes a back seat to perceived divine plans.
Okay, bringing it back to the immediate politics, Trump did set a condition for the Palestinians, right? Something about rebuilding.
Yes, he said. The Palestinians must rebuild, but not at the expense of tearing down Israel.
How did the commentator respond to that?
Uncompromisingly. They argue peace is simply impossible as long as the Hamas Charter exists, with its stated religious duty to destroy Israel.
So their conclusion is
that Gaza shouldn't be allowed to govern itself. They dismiss the ceasefire as fundamentally unstable because those core ideological goals haven't changed.
Right. Now, let's shift to another angle. The commentary takes this focus on allegiance and financial hypocrisy. This seems like another way they try to undercut the whole peace effort.
It is. The focus shifts to what they see as transactional politics, questioning loyalties. They bring up that anecdote involving the major donor, Miriam Adelson.
The story where Trump asked her if she loved the U.S. or Israel more?
That's the one. He apparently asked her right in front of all the assembled elites.
And she didn't answer directly. And Trump apparently said her allegiance might mean Israel. How does the commentary spin that?
They use her refusal to answer not just to suggest dual loyalty, but rhetorically to question the real motives of the powerful people funding these political efforts. Like, are they prioritizing U.S. interests or Israeli interests? It's a way to sow doubt about whose agenda is really being served.
Shifting the focus from policy to personal loyalty.
Exactly. And they immediately broaden that critique to the international level. Trump mentioned flying from the Knesset to a Gaza peace summit in Egypt.
Yeah.
And he observed it was the largest gathering of the richest nations on the planet.
Okay, and the commentary saw that as
deeply hypocritical. They argue these rich Gulf Arab states only want peace and security for purely selfish reasons to protect their own financial empires from instability.
But the commentator accuses them of playing both sides.
Precisely. The charge is a massive double standard. They claim these same nations are busy funding all the Islamic terrorism in the Middle East and Africa while demanding stability for their own investments.
So the argument is the whole peace effort is built on shaky, hypocritical foundations because of the funders involved.
That's the core of that particular critique. It suggests the summit, the whole deal, is superficial because the key players have conflicting, self-serving agendas.
All this criticism then leads to a direct takedown of Trump's claim that Israel is, what was it, safer now or stronger and more respected than in any other time since Bible times.
Yes. The commentary argues the complete opposite. They claim that because Israel hasn't, in their view, genuinely repented or changed, the world is against Israel.
And this is where the language gets really extreme.
It does. The source not only predicts that Ezekiel War of Gog Magog is coming soon, but actually attributes Israel's vulnerability, its destiny, to being, and this is their phrase, still ruled by the synagogue of Satan.
Okay, let's be absolutely clear here for you listening. That phrase, synagogue of Satan, is a specific, highly inflammatory term from the book of Revelation. Its use by this commentator is clearly intended to fundamentally challenge the religious and political legitimacy of the modern state of Israel.
Yes.
Asserting its leadership is corrupt and heading for divine judgment. We are reporting this extreme viewpoint from the source, definitely not endorsing it.
That's crucial context, because the commentator uses that language to argue that the modern state, despite military wins or diplomatic deals, is inherently flawed from their theological standpoint.
So it completely flips the Golden Age narrative on its head. Instead of triumph, they see impending doom.
Essentially, yes. Or at least that the current state isn't the one favored by God, and therefore this isn't a true Golden Age, but perhaps a setup for a prophesied downfall.
So where does this leave us? We started with this really optimistic vision of a new Golden Age celebrating victory, peace, and it's immediately met by this incredibly detailed commentary that just picks it apart, using biblical prophecy, political critique.
Right. And we saw their strategy, zeroing in on tiny things like that alleged Zionism slip or the mention of Calvary, using those details to suggest the whole peace process is unstable, maybe even insincere.
It really shows how much weight a single word or reference can carry in such a polarized situation. For the Knesset audience, or for the religious conservatives reading this commentary, those small details land heavily.
Absolutely. And in the end, you're left with two totally different versions of reality from the same event.
Yeah.
Trump presented this historic triumph, the end of the nightmare.
But the commentary we examine sees it as just a temporary ceasefire, maybe even a sign that much worse conflict is coming, driven by these deep fights over money, loyalty, and ultimately destiny.
Two completely irreconcilable narratives.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you. When you see a major political breakthrough announced, like this ceasefire, which story actually sticks in the public mind? Is it the hopeful political achievement, the optimistic vision, or is it the deeper, maybe more cynical critique, often rooted in historical fears or religious prophecy? Does that practical desire for stability always win out over those powerful ideological narratives? Something to think about long after the news cycle moves on.